From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. More and more things are getting embedded with intelligence, more every day. Now they are beginning to talk to one another. Soon, says Wired magazine, we'll be able to choreograph the physical world around us to respond to our desires. This hour, On Point, the Internet of Things and the programmable world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What do you say to this? Yes, please? No, thanks? Here we go. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The idea has been around a long time. Comedian Woody Allen had fun with it way back in the 1960s.
I was home one night. I called a meeting of my possessions. I got everything I owned into the living room, my toaster, my clock, my blender. They'd never been in the living room before. And I spoke to them. I opened with a joke. And then I said, I know what's going on, and cut it out. I have a sun lamp, and as I sit under it, it rains on me.
Woody Allen, I know what's going on. Cut it out. He wasn't so far off. These things are all getting linked up. But that was then. This is now, or at least closer, 2008 movie Iron Man. The character Tony Stark, Iron Man, played by Robert Downey Jr., designs a suit of armor on his holo table, a virtual drafting board connected to his house computer system, Jarvis.
Shall I store this on the Stark Industries central database?
I don't know who to trust right now. Until further notice, why don't we just keep everything on my private server?
Working on a secret project, are we, sir?
I don't want this winding up in the wrong hands.
Everything seems to respond to Iron Man. Joining me now from San Francisco is Bill Wasik, senior editor of Wired magazine. His cover story for this month's issue is headlined, Welcome to the Programmable World, where everything is awake, as the big headline goes. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Bill Wasik, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi there. Great to be here.
So I'm looking at a story. Wall Street Journal from 2 weeks ago says that by the year 2020, 50 billion objects, 50 billion with a B, objects on Earth will be intelligent and connected. Like what?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's everything from, you know, as Woody Allen joked about, the appliances in your home. Think about all of the various fixtures at your office, little, you know, parts of your car, a lot of stuff in the industrial space, you know, factory machines, some companies have been doing stuff with, locomotives. I mean, you can go on and on. These are little sensors around us that are giving off data. They're responding to simple commands. These aren't artificially intelligent, sentient devices. They're just devices that are that have a connection that we can get data out of them and we can put commands into them.
This isn't exactly a new idea, the Internet of Things, the idea has been around since the late 90s, but there's a lot of attention to it now. What is driving the focus on this, Bill?
Well, I would say part of it is that the technology has finally matured. And the reason for that is actually very interesting, which is that the sensors, these basic wireless technologies for communicating with objects are actually sensors that we use a lot in smartphones. And so as the smartphone revolution has taken off, the cost of these sensor chipsets has gotten lower and lower to the point that it's become feasible to put them inside pretty inexpensive small objects like, your coffee maker or your power outlet, your light switch. At this point, you can put a little low-energy Bluetooth chip, or there are some other technologies that we can talk about later that are in some of these devices. It's become more reasonable to put those chipsets into smaller and smaller things and to the point that you can sell these smart devices at a decent price.
Your piece is very practical about some of the things that are already happening and some that may soon. But what is the vision here? How, if 50 billion objects are sort of alive with a sensory kind of intelligence, what's the vision of where that takes us? And what portion of the physical world is that's wired up and awake, as you put it? What's the vision?
Well, it's a lot of it. I mean, I think that Right now, there are a lot of one-off devices that are smart. You know, you can get shoes from Nike that'll feed your, you know, your fitness data up into some website that you can go look at it. You know, there are these little fitness tracking bands. You know, there are some various medical devices that talk to your smartphone. I mean, these things right now tend to be they feel like one-off hookups in the sense that they're giving you some data or they let you control your, you know, the device through an app. It's in a very experimental phase. And I think what we tried to do with this article was to think beyond that, to try to make the point that once you get enough of these devices on the network, everything changes, because then you can start to coordinate them. You can have them talk to each other. You can have, you know, groups of devices act at the same time. You can control them all remotely. You can, in fact, create programs that will, you know, listen to one and based on what one says, tell the other one what to do. And so the idea of the programmable world is sort of like, you know, look, this isn't just about individual things being online. This is about what we can do when there are so many things online that they become sort of like a big single machine that we can make respond to our commands.
Bill Wasik writes, in our houses, cars, and factories were surrounded by tiny intelligent devices that capture data about how we live and what we do. Now they are beginning to talk to one another. Soon we'll be able to choreograph them to respond to our needs, solve our problems, even save our lives. Begin to take us, Bill, into more of the examples. As that choreography of intelligent devices begins to kick in, what might it look like? Let's start at home.
Sure. Well, so one example that some people might be familiar with is the thermostat. So there's a company called Nest that makes an intelligent home thermostat that essentially responds to your commands and learns the temperatures that you like at various times of the day, at times of the year. It essentially learns your habits and begins to mimic them. But beyond that,
What do you mean? That? Because I have a thermostat now. It's a regular old thermostat. It responds to my commands, and when I turn it, it gets hotter or colder.
Well, right. But right. So the idea is maybe around 8 o'clock at night in the, you know, fall, you want to turn it up to a certain temperature. And you do that 3 days in a row. On the fourth day, the Nest will do it for you automatically. Similarly, you know, it learns roughly when you go to bed based on when you stop walking by it, because it has a motion sensor in it. It learns what time you get up based on when you come and, you know, turn the knob to turn the heat on. You know, it essentially figures out your habits based on your patterns, and then it starts to follow those patterns by itself, to the point that eventually you can just sit there and pretty much, you know, 95% of the time your Nest will heat and cool your house like you want it. Except, and this is a big exception, it also tries to nudge you in the direction of saving more energy. So it will, you know, try to keep it a little bit colder, you know, when the heat is on. And if you go back down and turn it up again, it'll know, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. But the point is, it's trying to find ways to help you save energy and save money. And that's the big promise of it. It's a lot more expensive than a regular thermostat, but it will you know, for most people it will save them money over the long haul.
So there's my thermostat at home, tracking me, learning about me, and responding. We're kind of familiar to this pattern from Google. Already responds, you know, to your searches over time and other sites. Take it beyond.
I think that's a great analogy, in that, you know, Google is the master of taking all of these tiny little decisions that we make, right? You know, we're searching for X, and you know, then we click on this result, right? That's the fundamental insight behind Google, is that they watch what you're searching for, and then they watch what you click, and based on what you click, they know that's the answer you were looking for, and so then that feeds back into more intelligence. And I think that the programmable world is sort of much the same way, is that these little devices can learn from what we do and, you know, start to do those things better. you know, that it's a matter of taking data and having it feed back into a better system.
You've got all kinds of examples here. Basketball court tracks your shot percentage off the hoop out in the driveway.
Yeah, maybe. Right.
Garage door closes, lights turn off when you leave. That's pretty simple, but I guess I don't push the button anymore. Baby's room tries to soothe the baby back to sleep. If that doesn't work, texts you. Security camera activates alarm, tells off-duty cop to come by. If that's what you need, dog tag texts you when Rover leaves the yard. Swimming pool, if you've got one, heats up when there's a barbecue on the digital calendar, and on we go. Pretty soon, this is a almost living, breathing home.
Well, yeah, and I think, but I do think it's important to know, because you played the clip from Iron Man, is that this isn't really, this is not, you know, the singularity that we're talking about. This is not, you know, artificial intelligence of the sort that you think of from movies, right? This is not the house, you know, this is not, you know, Hal refusing to open the pod bay doors. This is more like a computer where you know, write programs that it runs and it sort of becomes your servant.
Well, so you say, but it's going to nudge me, and nudges get interesting in a hurry. The music of all those dancing brooms from The Sorcerer's Apprentice behind us right here. We're talking this hour about the Internet of Things and programming the physical world. Bill Wasik is with us, senior editor at Wired Magazine. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the Internet of Things and programming the physical world. It's coming, it's happening, it's going to get your attention if it hasn't already. Bill Wasik is with us, senior editor at Wired Magazine, wrote this month's cover feature, "In the Programmable World, All Our Objects Will Act as One." You can link to the article at our website, onpointradio.org. And yes, here's that interaction that Bill says is not where we're headed from 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
And there you go. The smart object, in that case, Hal, takes over the spaceship, and we're in trouble. Bill Wasik joins us from San Francisco. Bill, let's get some callers right in here. Bruce in Los Angeles, California. Bruce, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to answer your question to the audience at the top of the show about, you know, is this good, is this bad, or is it just here we go?
Yep.
I think it's here we go. I think it's maybe it's even here we go again, because, you know, I think it's human nature to fear the spread of technology, or, you know, you could say the pervasion of technology. And for hundreds of years, it's been human nature to sort of fear the downside of that. And, you know, what's going to happen if Hal won't let me save myself? But I think, you know, we've always adjusted as it's, you know, the new technologies come out. You know, I think at this point, after looking back through history of, you know, oh, the horrible things that the car is going to bring to us and ruin our culture and our society, or I don't know this, but I would imagine that when the wheel was invented millions of years ago, people decried it as spoiling current life and, you know, how are we ever going to adapt?
So you don't quite say bring it on, Bruce, but you're saying, what, if it happens, we'll live with it. This is the way human nature goes.
I think I'm saying I have faith in mankind that, yes, we're going to mess it up sometimes, but for the most part, I think we will figure out a way to not let it ruin us and, you know, just use it as a tool as intended.
Bruce, I appreciate your call. Bill, do you have that confidence it's just going to flow into life as we know it? I mean, there could be glitches along the way. For one, as you cite, all this stuff takes a lot of energy, that thing which is a little problematic in the world these days.
No, for sure. I mean, my feeling is we will, here we go off in that direction. I think that there will be issues of privacy. There will be issues of security. I think that we will deal with those as we sort of always have, which is, you know, the society, the cultural norms are changed by the new technology on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, uses of the technology that seem sort of egregious from our old norms sort of don't really take off, or they take a long time to take off, you know. And I think that we have managed to strike that balance pretty well with with technologies, as he says, going back to the automobile, which obviously changed society in an incredible way, through the internet, through the mobile revolution. And I think that you know, the era of smart things, the programmable world, will be much the same.
I want to welcome Jason Johnson into our conversation right now, also from San Francisco, technologist, chairman of the Internet of Things Consortium, CEO of August. Jason Johnson, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Bill's been talking about what this might mean in the house. Take us out of the house, Jason, as we're out in the world. As more things smarten up, what's it going to mean? What might the experience be like?
Yeah, so, you know, this burgeoning Internet of Things devices can of course touch us in many different ways, right? We're basically seeing connectivity being added to perhaps everyday objects, things we interact with on a daily basis. So we talked about things in the home, things in your car, things in your office, and as they have connectivity and as they interact together, some real value can be created, and that's the important thing about all of this is you have to identify where is there a real problem to be solved. And you know, the consortium members, of course, are spending a lot of time thinking about what those problems are and how they can work together to solve those.
Give us some examples of out in the world. What are you going to do for us with the Internet of Things, the programmable world?
I last week we unveiled the August Smart Lock, and the particular problem, you know, we're seeking to solve at August is the management of keys. So we're all using these metal jagged keys that really haven't changed in hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And in our cars, of course, we have these wireless keys, and many of us at our offices have wireless key cards. But in our homes, we still use these old mechanical locks. And what the August Smart Lock does is it attaches to the existing lock on your home. And as you approach your home using your smartphone, it authenticates you and allows you or somebody you've given access to enter the home. And this really opens up a wide range of possibilities, not just like your guests and your friends and family members, but services that you would perhaps invite to come into your home.
The plumber calls, he's at the front door, and I punch him in from work.
You know, that is one use case, but one what we really see is the ability for you, real time from your office, from wherever you are, to issue a key remotely to somebody, giving them temporary access for a set amount of time on a set days, and you know when they enter the home, you know when they've left. It's leveraging the new smartphone technology, of course, cloud-based access management, and then, of course, the devices that we're making at August.
So in the old days, I lose my key, I can't get in. Now I lose my cell phone, I can't get in, Jason.
Yeah, well, you know, cell phones are interestingly enough, they're something that we carry with us quite a bit. In fact, the studies we've done have shown that people are more likely to leave their keys inside their house and say head to the office in the morning, but their phones they have with them. So these phones are quite attached to us. And then, of course, you know, Bill's excellent article in Wired this month talks about all the other sensors that we carry on us now. We have these personal, you know, activity trackers on our wrists, and soon we'll have other objects, perhaps on our eyes and other parts of our body that will also have the same technology that your phone does that will allow you to interact with objects such as your door lock or
lock. Just approach it and it opens for me, recognize me. I can see some of these things coming on pretty quickly. Bill, you write about the time, maybe not too far off, where you walk into your favorite coffee shop, it recognizes you maybe again by your cell phone, and you don't even stand in line. They just prepare your drink for you, maybe take the payment as well, and you get to skip the line and just find your drink on the bar.
Yeah, well, you know, and in general, I would say, and this speaks to the lock this authentication question, right? I mean, we've been using the phrase Internet of Things, but in a lot of ways, the most interesting sensors are actually the ones that are on us, authenticating us. You know, one of the companies I write about in the piece is called SmartThings, and they essentially have a home hub to connect sort of all of your various connected devices. But one of the ones that the things that they have that is essentially just a presence tag, and it's basically just a tag that's attached to you, that's affiliated with you, and when you walk in the house knows that you are there. And it turns out there are a bunch of fascinating applications that you can have with that technology. And as you say, one of the things about authentication, whether it's through your cell phone or through one of these tags, is you go into a retail establishment and they know who you are. You know, imagine that the you know, retailer knows what size you are and can already start, you know, picking out pants for you based on your measurements. Although I guess if you've eaten too much, then they might need to adjust that.
But. Or offering you coupons. You say, here's a listener on the web, Creaker says, it'll get creepy when the monitors in stores start targeting ads specifically to you as you walk by. We saw that. We've seen that in the movies already. But Bill, you're right. That's what's coming.
Well, you know, I think so. I mean, certainly the ability to do that is coming. But again, we're having this conversation about, well, how far is too far? It may well be that, you know, walking into Target and walking by the end cap and having the end cap say, like, hey, hey, Bill, you want what I'm selling? That might actually be too creepy, and so we might actually that technology might be available, and people might try it, and they might actually find, you know, we don't want to go that direction right now. And that to me is what's really interesting about this stuff is that it's all in give and take with social norms, and we're going to nudge those social norms like we always have. And I think already, you know, you look over the last 20 years, and we're a lot more comfortable with more of our data being out there, kind of more things being available that are associated with us. You know, we already have these cell phones that, you know, that track our position. You know, we have easy passes in our car. But it might be that some of this personalization stuff winds up being a bridge too far, at least in the short term.
It's going to be wild to see what takes and what doesn't. The chair at your office that just recognizes you and automatically adjusts to exactly where you want it to be. You're not saying, hey, who moved my chair? It's moving for you. And lots of things around you, as Bill Wasik describes them, moving, changing, adapting for you as you come into their arena. Chris in Springfield, Illinois is calling. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a little less concerned about the social ramifications than I am about the security.
Okay.
I've worked in IT since 93, and not a whole lot of internet security, but I'm always aware of the fact that any computer you get on is not 100% secure. So if all of our devices are wirelessly connected through something we have on us, even if it's, you know, an implanted chip in your wrist or whatever,
yeah,
what is to prevent anyone from hacking that and taking over your devices, or even, you know, taking the thing if it's on your keychain and then they have free reign with all your devices? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Jason, I'll bring that to you. Here's another listener online with the kind of the same concern. Mark says, industrialists, bureaucrats, consumers are making themselves ever more vulnerable to cyber mayhem in ways beyond the imagination of most people. Not everything should be wired into everything. I mean, we're already seeing all these reports of American infrastructure, power plants and dams, and I don't know what vulnerable to, you know, a hacker on the other side of the world. What about security in this arena, Jason?
You know, security is paramount to all these technologies, right? It's and we've seen this in other adoptions of technologies. You know, my father still hasn't used an ATM machine, right? He still thinks that's putting him at risk. And in fact, as an example, it took quite a bit of time for people to get comfortable with ATM machines, and in recent years, getting comfortable with online banking. Right, I think most of us, you know, are accessing our bank accounts online, and we're trusting that information to be there, and we trust it to be there because there's been demonstration by the financial institutions that they can do things very securely. Right, you haven't heard about, you know, these egregious breaches of people having all the money sucked out of their Citibank or Chase accounts.
Yep.
It hasn't happened because,
well,
you take those steps, and we of course, you know, members of the consortium, and of course August as a company that has access control, we have to have that level of security and build that confidence with consumers.
But Bill, I mean, you write pretty plainly that that's not as easy as it sounds. There are new vulnerabilities that come along with this.
No, absolutely. I you know, I would say that it is to take the banking example that Jason made. You know, I think what you hear about is people learning your personal information and essentially pretending to be you by knowing what it is that you know, whether it's your password or your address or your credit card number, these things that are they're essentially forms of passwords. You know, what I would say about Internet of Things security is that by taking the password out of the equation, we actually have the potential to make some of this stuff more secure. I mean, what you don't hear about with hackers typically is that they're decrypting these like massively encrypted, you know, back-end data streams that are moving the money around, because de-encrypting stuff that's encrypted is actually super hard to do. The password, sort of our knowledge, the thing that we type in, is always the weakest link. And so, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that we're becoming more secure by going to an Internet of Things world. I mean, obviously, more connected devices means more stuff to hack and more vulnerability. But I will say that it's not crazy to imagine that actually taking some of this stuff out of human, reducing the kind of having to type in a password part of the equation might actually make us more secure.
Maybe. I mean, but I'm sure you saw this in December. Vanity Fair had this article about all the medical devices that are being implanted now and saying it's only a matter of time before smartphones become the smart person's murder weapon of choice. The day is not right, far off when the manipulation of medical devices will be done by punching keys on a smartphone, putting an individual's internal organs in the hands of every hacker, online scammer, and digital vandal on Earth. Woo, watch out, Bill.
Yeah, I know, right? The hacking somebody's pacemaker is pretty much an awesome movie plot.
Take them down in a hurry. Let me get Cooper from New Orleans on here. Cooper, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This whole topic reminds me a lot of a project by a group called the Situationist Internationals, and they basically designed this conceptual architecture of a massive city where every sort of space that we moved through would be responsive to us, whether it was the color of the space or the temperature.
Yeah.
And the sort of goal with their project was all leisure-based. It mm-hmm. came from a society where all work was automated, and we would just sort of move around and experience these programmable spaces. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the goal of this sort of current trend, and if it's just more efficiency for more work, or if it's based more on a leisure and enjoyment. And I'll take my answer.
Cooper, I'll get it, but let me ask you, what do you think of let's say it's leisure-based. Is that appealing to you? If New Orleans would shift and morph around you, Cooper, as you walk through the city, would you like that?
Well, first of all, I don't think New Orleans needs more emphasis on leisure. It's got enough of it. But I think that the danger is that it seems like it just sort of heightens whatever you're focused on right now. Like, if you need to get more work done, then it will free you up to do more work. But if you're privileged enough to enjoy some leisure time, then it will free you up to do that more.
That sounds like wisdom. Jason, how about it? Do you think this will be more focused on work efficiency or leisure and enjoyment?
Well, I think that there's definitely applications for both, and you know, we like to, you know, look at the home a lot, right? So you know, as you come in proximity to the front door of your home, August detects who you are, and of course it unlocks the door, but also Bill mentioned smart things earlier. We can send a trigger to smart things and turn on other devices in the home, your lights, your temperature up, your music, and you know, that's all fun stuff. I mean, it moves somewhere between leisure and being productivity or energy savings.
Maybe it'll be both. Maybe it'll be all. Maybe it'll be everything. Jason Johnson with the Internet of Things Consortium, CEO of August, joining us from San Francisco. Jason, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
We've got a little bit of virtual insanity right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the Internet of Things and programming the physical world. It is coming. It is happening already. It's going to get your attention if it has not already. Bill Wasik has written the big cover story in Wired magazine. The big headline is Awake, and he's talking about things awake. In the programmable world, all our objects will act as one. kind of choreographed around us, Bill Wasik writes. He joins us today from San Francisco. Questions here from our listener, from Facebook, Bill. Benedict says, you know, how many of us can already use their TV or VCR or Blu-ray or DVD remote and know what all the buttons do? Imagine that everything has a set of those, you know, online. If you program everything, how big is the remote going to be that that lets us manipulate everything? And is that conceivably manageable, Bill?
Well, I think that, it's what I think a lot of people who are thinking in this space are thinking about is not just how to get all this stuff connected, but also how to make it intuitive to control it for regular human beings. So, I mean, to take the TV as an example, you know, one of the I was talking to, I was down visiting Qualcomm, which is a big wireless connectivity company based down in San Diego. And one of the things that they're working on in their labs is the question of how you stream, you know, how you take video that you might have on your cell phone and throw it up onto a screen in a room. And there might be, you know, three different screens in the room, but you want to intuitively be able to essentially push it, you know, to the right screen. So my point just being that I think that for this to take off, you'll need a lot of smart people thinking not just about how to connect the devices, but how to make it in some ways more intuitive than it is now to get the thing that you want to happen with the device. And I think that that's definitely possible with the technology that we have.
Bring it on. But I've been waiting on that on the TV for a long time. Dave says you might want to mention IFTTT, if this, then that, IFT. That's a big deal in this world. Explain it to us, Bill.
Well, IFTTT is a really interesting. Are you talking about the service or just sort of the principle?
Well,
right.
Both,
yeah. So
I
there's.
Guess.
The, well, yeah. I mean, there's a web service that basically takes various streams in your life. So it might be, you know, your Twitter feed or your Facebook feed, or, you know, I think you can even connect your email. I'm not that familiar with all of it, but essentially says, hey, if this thing happens, then do this other thing, right? It's sort of similar to a Google alert, but it's essentially for everything. It basically allows you to program your own if-then relationships.
So project that into the physical world. Where does
go? And so you know, I write about this company SmartThings in the magazine, and really what SmartThings sort of is an IFTTT for physical stuff, in that you. Is that you can basically create apps within their mobile app. You basically create apps for your stuff. So you might, you know, link all of your downstairs lights together and then press a button and they all turn on, and press the button again and they all turn off. Or you might have some routine that you run where at the same time every morning, you know, the lights downstairs turn on and your coffee maker turns on and, you know, this whole suite of things happen. So it's basically a way to program the programmable world. And I think this idea of if-then relationships is really important to understanding how this can play out, because it really is – it takes them from being these one-off novelties to being a system that we can do stuff with.
Mark writes to us, just give me a knob. He says, I've been immersed in high tech since the days of coal-fired mainframes. At the end of the day, when I am not wired in, I am living the dream, smelling the roses, walking on sunshine. He wants to be away from everything that's programmed. Mary in Harbor Springs, Michigan. Mary, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, I have to say, I first of all, I really appreciate the way you host your show and the way that you deal with the issues.
Thanks.
But today, I don't think that it matters whether we like it, whether we would, you know, whether we want it or not. It's coming anyway, and we're going to have to deal with it. And your screener said to me, so are you embracing the inevitable? And I said, no, I'm bracing for the inevitable because the level of stress that comes with all these things, I mean, you know, if they could do something about that would be great. I suppose I sound like a Luddite, but that's the way it is.
Well, you're a Luddite who's bracing, saying, I don't know, you're not in denial. I don't know if it'll come or not. If enough people really don't like it, maybe it won't happen. On the other hand, when everybody else is getting their coffee served up on the bar and you're standing in line, you know, the leverage sets in. Mary, I appreciate your call. Brace yourself. Maybe here we go. Maybe not. I want to invite Sherry Turkle into our conversation right now. She is director of MIT's Initiative on Technology and Self, expert on mobile technology, social networking, social robotics, author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. Sherry Turkle, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
So there's our caller in Michigan who says she may like it and she may not, but she's bracing for it. Here it comes. Is this the future, Sherry? Is it inevitable?
Well, you know, a lot of people are working on it. A lot of people are excited about it. But I think it doesn't have to be the future. If people are saying my bliss is to disconnect because this stuff exhausts me, I know it's coming. I think I'll hate it, but I'm bracing. I mean, I think we have to. I think it's better to assume that as technology becomes more mature, mm-hmm. and we become more mature with it, that consumers kind of have a voice in what they want. Some of the values, I read Bill's article really clearly, and some of the values that are embedded in this fantasy of a frictionless world are not necessarily so attractive.
Well, speak to that. That's very interesting.
I mean,
like
for
what?
For example, why do we want to be steered away from all unpleasantness? Are we so keen on this frictionless world? Just because technology says there's a problem to be solved doesn't mean there's a problem. I mean, why do we want to be steered away from ex-girlfriends and towards friends? I mean, why smooth?
Which is one thing Bill describes here. Hey, well, heads up, watch out. There's an ex-girlfriend a block over.
I mean,
turn left here.
These examples, you know, you're walking along the street. You make sure you don't see anybody, you make sure you don't see your ex-girlfriend. You make sure you only see your friends. I mean, the reason we live, you know, I'm not saying we want to, root ourselves towards altercations at all costs.
Yeah.
We live in cities because we want to have a degree of serendipity in our lives. So, you know, whose value is it?
Yeah, but I wonder if, I mean, you say people may just disconnect and not do it, but isn't the history of technology that most people go with the flow and a few resist and don't do it, but suddenly they're the Amish? Or if we go back further, you say we live in cities. Of course, there was a time when we did not. And, you know, people thought cities were too overwhelming. You know, we lived in the wild. Maybe the new wild, Sherry, will be anything that's not programmed to accommodate us. Any place where the chair doesn't rise and fit my hinder is wild.
I'm saying that this may be a psychological misperception of what accommodates us. In other words, who says that what accommodates us as people, and how, in what we enjoy, is equating. For example, there's an equation of having your phone tell you the price of goods in a market, and having your phone tell you, in other words, an efficiency in buying your grocery, an efficiency in telling you what's in a painting in an art museum. So the Internet of Things lets quantification go to a point where it allows you to look at everything through conveniences lens. There's a kind of, if it's information, it's all equal. And I think people kind of enjoy a little bit of a sense that the information about pricing isn't the same as the information about art.
Well, I mean, traditionally, we also learn about ourselves by difficulty, by dealing
difficulty,
with resistance.
By talking to each other, and I think it's what I got out of this very interesting and very dense article is the way the same sentences include, and I think it's very telling because I teach at MIT and I can't say that this article is kind of a one-off. I mean, this is how people talk, which is what made the article so compelling, because it's actually quite a typical argument, is that these things are included in the same sentences, the ex-girlfriend and the friends and the art museum and the price of coffee, that information becomes information, things start to seem equal, quantification lets us go to places it couldn't go before. So, as I say, it lets us look at everything through convenience's lens.
On the other hand, Sherry, what, you know, let's say you've got your desk chair and you share your office with a few other people, mm-hmm. and the chairs get mixed up, and every other day you come in and it's not yours and you're swearing as you adjust it. What would the harm be if the chair could read the chip in your phone and say, oh, it's Sherry. I know just exactly how she likes me to be arrayed and, you know, adapt to you as you sit down. Would that be an offense to humanity?
I think that there's an argument here where people take the simple, and this is another thing that I think is typical mm-hmm. of the argument. It's kind of like arguing from the easy case. Mm. Do I mind if I'm in the right desk chair? No. But here's what I object to. Mm-hmm. You start with an argument that's really simple. Do you want to be in your right desk chair? Yeah, I kind of want to be in my right desk chair. But then two sentences later,
yeah.
here's what I object to.
Right.
And here's a sentence that really kind of follows an argument on desk chair.
Yeah.
Just as with social networking, the privacy concerns of a sensor-connected world will be fast outweighed by the strange pleasures of residing in it. And that's a fundamental assumption of this argument. And, you know, I think that we haven't yet really gotten used to the privacy concerns of the world of social networks.
Where we are now.
I think we're struggling with it by denying it. We're mostly denying with it. Where whenever we bump against it, we try not to look at it. We really haven't written the laws yet to deal with it.
And we're still plunging ahead. Sherry, stand by. Bill, what about it? Are you willing to, I don't know, put everything on the altar of this stress-free tailored world?
Well, you know, there's an expression that people have been talking about, online when people talk about technology called the Borg mentality, right? Which is, you know, resistance is futile.
Yeah.
And it's easy to talk about technology, and I would certainly concede that parts of my article might slide into it here and there, is the idea that, oh, this is coming and it's going to change all of our lives and there's nothing we can do to stop it. In reality, I think a lot of this stuff is going to be elective, right? I mean, and in that way, I think it's somewhat different from the rise of the mobile phone, where it pretty quickly created a culture where you had to have one or else you essentially couldn't live in the modern world. I think a lot of this stuff is about, because it's about personalization, it's very much about kind of what you do or don't want. I mean, the ex-girlfriend thing was a sort of tongue-in-cheek example in a picture. But I mean, if there are people who want to avoid people they don't want to see, I mean, sure, you could program this world to do that for you. I don't think that's going
to be
common.
Here's a listener who says she went to the bank last week. The computer was down. She could not get any cash. I mean, it can make it just really hard to function. Randy in Matthews, North Carolina. Randy, you're on the air. What do you think?
Well, this whole conversation reminds me of a really interesting young adult fiction book I read called Feed, F as in Frank, E-E-D as in dog.
Yeah.
And everybody had a chip in their brain implanted at birth that tracked their movements and what they liked and what they didn't like. And like you said, you know, you go to the mall and it says, hey, Frank, we've got Levi's in your size on sale down at such and such a store. And it came so far to the point that they even communicated with each other by just thinking. And so your brain talked to my brain and no one actually had out loud conversations. And it was such a really thought-provoking and interesting book, and creepy, too, at the same time. But
do you want to live there, Randy? Do you want to live in that world a little bit or no?
It was constant bombardment of information, constant. And there was a girl in the book who was sort of like what you might think of like a prairie girl. Her parents had chosen not to implant the feed in her brain, and it showed how she manipulated through this world that everybody else had to feed. You guys should read it. It's really cool.
Feed by M.T. Anderson. Randy, thanks very much for your call. Sherry, all this, I was reading Bill last night and also thinking about the brand new Supreme Court ruling saying that, you know, anytime you're arrested, they can take your DNA and you don't have much or anything to say about it. And then all that is on record as well. I mean, when things start talking and there's a big database that has my DNA in it, I don't know where this ends.
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of things that we used to consider, I mean, stepping back for a moment, I mean, I think that a lot of things that we used to consider dystopian are now being presented to us as though they're utopian. But that really is a change of emotional, psychological, moral climate that we can object to.
But those climates always change, don't they? I mean,
yeah, but that doesn't mean that when they change, you know, it's not, you can still say mind control, taking my DNA, having that kind of power over who I am, what I can become, how you can track me, that is not really consonant with, that's a step backward for the power of the individual.
Bill Wasik, you're the editor here. What are you predicting for, I don't know, your children or your grandchildren? Are they just going to accept this as the way things is? The house responds to me when I walk in all kinds of ways. That's the way it is.
Well, I would say more generally, I mean, just as we've gone from a sort of a PC world to a mobile world where the devices have gotten smaller, and, you know, on the one hand, it means we are sort of pulled away into the digital world more often. But on the other hand, it means that we're untethered from, you know, a particular place, and it sort of allows the digital world to be a kind of overlay and augmentation to our lives. And I think, you know, it's about using it in a way that works for us, sort of, you know, both in terms of our daily lives and emotionally. But I think that it's in some ways could allow for us to, you know, be less mired in our screens and our machines and sort of live our lives more in the physical world.
Augmented and more free, we will see. This is really interesting stuff. Bill Wasik is senior editor at Wired Magazine. He writes about it in the big cover story, Awake. In the programmable world, all our objects will act as one. You can link to it at our website. Bill, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks.
And Sherry Turkle at MIT. You headed for your grass hut up in Vermont, Sherry? You going to hide out?
Well, it's my Wi-Fi, but I'm not into my house watching my kids.
Okay, well, good luck. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.